With China falling and jobs rising, the theme of the program today goes like this. Things are neither as bad nor as good as they seem. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Friday. This one is the 8th of January. Good as always to have you with us, everybody. And I don't know about y'all, but I have had about enough economic excitement this week to last me all year. Sadly, that is not the way things are going to shake out, more likely than not. So we might as well understand exactly what happened the 5 days gone by. Here to wrap up the week with us are Lee Gallagher from Fortune Magazine. David Gura is at Bloomberg. Hey, everybody.
Hey, Kai.
All right, we got to start with jobs, I think, right, Lee? 292,000, that's great. Unemployment at 5% still. Anything to add? I mean, it was good, right?
It was better than expected. Wages were up. The previous months were revised up. I mean, it was really good, and it was expected to be good, and it even was better than that. So I don't want to, you know, as you say, things are neither as good or as bad as they look, but it was a pretty good one.
It was a big number. Yeah. Like, that came out, I think I wasn't alone being surprised at the size
of
it.
Right.
So, yeah, I think it was a pretty good report.
All right, good. So let us move on then to the not-so-good of the week, David. China and the mess over there, not necessarily the stock market itself, but what it says about the underlying economy in that country. Help me out here, man.
Yeah, well, help you out. Help.
All right, help us all out,
us out here,
David,
you know?
Please help me.
No, I think everyone just trying to figure out what the state of the economy is. You make the distinction all the time, Kai. I hear you between the market and the economy itself. But investors I talked to this week just stymied by how poorly the Chinese government, Chinese regulators are communicating about what they're doing. And, you know, we talk a lot about uncertainty here in the U.S. My God, the amount of uncertainty there. You have these switch breakers put in there for 4 days. They take them out. The government intervenes. It doesn't intervene. You just see it devalue its currency to its lowest level in a long time.
Yeah.
So I think investors just really trying to figure out the psychology of the Chinese market, which is pretty young and, as you know, has so many participants in it now, like 100 million retail investors now in China.
All of whom, by the way, I read the other day, have less than a decade of experience, which totally makes sense, right? So you're like, oh, man. Lee, let me ask you the global question, though. With the American economy going reasonably strong, actually really strong, right? With jobs up and GDP up and all that stuff, there are some problems, but we're going strong.
Yeah,
The rest of the world maybe not, though. Is it going to bite us in the tuchus?
Well, I think in the beginning, it's good for us. I mean, we're the safe port in the storm, and that is only good. I mean, there are ramifications for a strong dollar and other things. But I think the other thing, by the way, normally when things are going crazy geopolitically, like in the Middle East in particular, oil prices go way up and oil prices are way down. So even that is good. So the thing is, what if things start to go bad here? Then there's nowhere else to go, and then it kind of
that's
one possible question.
And then, David, we become the best looking horse in the glue factory.
Yeah, and I think to an extent,
right?
There you go. Exactly. But we heard
horse
from Stan Fisher.
Don't write in.
There you go. I know that they will.
Yeah.
We had Stan Fisher, the vice chair of the Fed, saying this week that the world matters to us. Obviously, the Fed paying close attention to all of this. We got their minutes from their last pivotal meeting this week, indicating that what's happening globally is still very much on their minds. And you look at the probability of another rate hike here, probably won't take place until March. That does give policymakers some time just to see how all of this shakes out, how much glue gets made, I guess.
Right. Lee, let me ask you very quickly about the markets. I don't want to dwell on the ups and the downs. I just want to comment briefly that stocks going down, which we've had a lot of this week, is not necessarily a bad thing.
It's not a bad thing. I mean, stocks are very richly valued. And, you know, you could see this as a buying opportunity. I mean, many people, I'm sure, do. The long term, it's like, you know, every investor book says this, the long term trend, you are never going to go wrong if you just don't panic. You never want to panic. You never want to move things at a time like this. But yeah, I would agree with that.
Buy and hold. All right, Gura, you get the last word today, and it's this on my opening thesis. Things are neither as bad nor as good as they look. Discuss.
No, it's – I mean, look, it's – what are we, 5 days into the new year? It's been a really bad 5 days. I think the worst 5-day start to the year for the S&P ever. That sort of thing is shocking. And as Lee says, you want to be patient. You want to sort of weather the volatility, but it's hard when all of this is happening in the background. We're heading up into earnings season now. I think that's probably going to throw some more shocks at us. So It's hard, but I'll side with Lee. That is, right. Stay calm.
David Gura, he's on TV now at Bloomberg, and Lee Gallagher, you know, he used to be on the radio. We got to own it. Lee Gallagher's at Fortune Magazine. You guys have a good weekend, all right?
Thanks, Kai.
You too.
All right, take care. About Wall Street today, sticking with the theme, I will say only this. It wasn't as bad as it looks. And also, just because Gura brought it up, that whole Dow Jones Industrial Average isn't the economy, and the economy isn't the Dow Jones Industrial Average. Listen and learn that. We will have more, of course, when we do the numbers. There was a blip. A dark spot, a blemish, if you will, on the jobs report that we got this morning. It's not a new one. It's the big bugaboo in the American labor market. Now the jobs themselves are back. Wages, to cut to the chase, and how they are growing or not growing, truth be told. In fact, average hourly earnings fell just a hair last month, exactly what we don't want to be happening, even though, as Lee said, they're up year on year. We asked Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer what's going on.
When I started talking to labor experts for this story, one thing became clear. Everybody's got an opinion on why wages aren't rising faster. Opinion number one from Seth Harris, a former acting labor secretary, now at Cornell.
There's still far too many workers for too few jobs.
Harris says there's still a bunch of people on the sidelines. With a big labor pool, employers don't have to raise wages to attract workers. So average hourly earnings rose just 2.5% in 2015. Normally, at this point in a recovery, they'd be increasing 3 or 4%. And then there's opinion number two.
There has been a marked shift in the way workers take their pay home.
That's Andrew Chamberlain, chief economist at the website Glassdoor. He says about 10 years ago, 29% of the average paycheck came in the form of benefits. Today, it's more than 31%. So,
if people are taking more compensation in the form of benefits, they will take less in the form of wages, and that will depress the official wage numbers.
Of course, that's only for people in jobs with benefits. Chamberlain also says productivity needs to pick up before we see healthy wage gains. That brings us to Gary Chason. He teaches labor relations at Clark University. He says productivity may play a role, but
we're really not quite sure what's going on over here. The problem is that everyone is always trying to twist the data to support their own point of view.
Chason says you can have a million theories, but there's only one conclusion.
This is not normal, but this is going to become the new normal.
The question, Chason says, is what are we going to do about it? In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
All right, so you got your big-time IPOs, companies like Google going public back in the day, or Facebook more recently, and then you got your IPOs. The National Oil Company of Saudi Arabia, Saudi Aramco it's called, confirmed today that it is, and this is a quote, studying options for selling a part of itself to the public. Quick bit of history here before we go on. Way back in the 1940s, Aramco was owned by various arms of Standard Oil until it was fully nationalized by the Saudi Arabian government. So why, given the state of affairs right now, talk about selling today? From the Sustainability Desk, Marketplace's Scott Tong is on that one.
Okay, multiple choice. Is Aramco worth A, $100 billion, or B, $2.5 trillion, or C, $10 trillion? The answer is D, nobody knows until the shares actually list. But everyone's asking, and why list now? Many assume the company and the Saudi government need money with oil prices low. Consultant Robin Mills of Manar Energy in Dubai spoke by Skype.
You can hardly think of a more of a crown jewel state company anywhere in the world. This has now been raised publicly as a huge step, and I think that would only have been done with these concerns about the economic and the budget situation.
Others say Aramco has plenty of ways to raise money. It can borrow, it can float bonds. So the company may see a broader change of foot, like fossil fuel risk. Nansen Saleri is the CEO of Quantum Reservoir Impact, and he worked at Saudi Aramco for a decade.
Decarbonization is a concept that's playing more and more into day-to-day decisions. So Aramco going down this path, I see it as a risk mitigation step.
Saudi's deputy crown prince told The Economist that listing shares would boost transparency. But Valerie Marcel at the Chatham House think tank in London says there's no way the company fully opens its books.
then there might be questions asked about the level of spending of the royal family, which I think is a very sensitive issue. But also the company's corporate culture is very secretive. It's the legacy company that comes from ExxonMobil, and ExxonMobil is also a very secretive company.
One way to stay secret is for Aramco to offer a tiny, non-controlling stake to the public. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Crude oil, by the way, down 10% for the week, 12-year lows. U.S. benchmark prices now at $33.16 a barrel. A couple of years ago, a group of businesses in a suburb of Cleveland, Ohio, decided to get in early on what could turn out to be our economic future. They started accepting Bitcoin, the digital currency. The response was huge at first. Customers flocked to what became known as Bitcoin Boulevard. But the hype, as so often happens, has faded. From WCPN in Cleveland, Elizabeth Miller has more.
Along a lane of small retail stores, restaurants, and bars, nine independent Cleveland Heights businesses banded together to form Bitcoin Boulevard in May 2014. But today, two of those businesses have closed, and one is not actively accepting Bitcoin. Mitchell's Fine Chocolates is one of the original nine businesses.
Good afternoon, sir. 2-pound box, all dark.
We offer 80 or 90 different kinds of assortments, both in dark and milk chocolates.
Owner Bill Mitchell says he started seeing a drop in Bitcoin payment when its value dwindled at the beginning of 2015.
Since the latter part of the winter of this year going through the end of October, it's been deader than a doornail.
He's not the only one seeing a drop in Bitcoin business. Sean Paul Salon says it's only had 6 Bitcoin transactions in the past 18 months. That's a lot less exciting than everyone had hoped. Again, Bill Mitchell.
I had a Korean television crew in here when the big splash occurred last spring. With an interpreter and the whole thing.
Here he is from that show.
As you know, I'm sure in Korea it's expensive to use credit cards.
Within 2 months of Bitcoin Boulevard's debut in May 2014, the currency was valued at more than $650. Now it's dropped to far less. The problem, according to Case Western Reserve University banking professor William Monick, is Bitcoin's instability.
My Bitcoin is worth X at 9 o'clock, and it's worth X minus 1 or plus 1 at 9:01. How do you get over that? You know, the money in your wallet or your credit card is stable.
Monick says Bitcoin is appealing because it charges no transaction fees to merchants. Some credit cards have transaction fees between 2 and 4%. With Bitcoin, transaction fees are decided by the merchant and the customer, and sometimes they decide to complete the transaction without a fee. Rebecca Grinham is a Cleveland Heights native who shops at Bitcoin Boulevard's Revive, a fair trade boutique. She uses Bitcoin because it's independent of credit card fees.
All of my money was going directly to the business owner, therefore going directly to my local economy and benefiting my community.
Grinham hasn't used Bitcoin since 2014 due to the price drop. But even at a lower price, Bitcoin still has its supporters among business owners and customers. Emily Satin is the manager of a free trade shop called Revive. She says Bitcoin usage brought welcome attention to the city.
We had great response, a lot of questions also, which was great to open dialogue and to learn a little more about what this digital currency is.
Organizers of Bitcoin Boulevard say the next step is to work with state legislators to modify Ohio liquor laws so Bitcoin can be used to purchase alcohol. In Cleveland, I'm Elizabeth Miller for Marketplace.
Coming up.
I've had seasonal, like, retail jobs and lasted, like, a couple of months, but that's basically it.
Unemployment is down, yes, but not for everybody. First, though, let's do the numbers. Oh, can I vote no on the mandolins? Do I get a vote on this music? Dow Industrial's off 167 points today. 1% ended things at 16,346. The NASDAQ declined 45 points, nearly 1%. 46.43. The S&P 500 dropped 21 points, 1%. closed at 1922, if in fact they are mandolins. I don't even know. This, as we all know, is a week to forget. In the past 5 days, the Dow off 6%, the NASDAQ off 7.25%, the S&P 500 dropped 6%. Let me say it again, though, that is not necessarily a bad thing. Sharks are circling Time Warner with some news reports that activist investors want the company to spin off HBO. Time Warner shares rose 1.3% on that news. No safe haven in gold at all. Kinross Gold fell 6.5%. Barrick Gold declined 3.4%. Concerns about the strength of holiday sales continue to hit some retailers and hit them hard. Gap down 14% today, 1.4%. Kohl's shares fell 5.8%. Bond prices rose. When that happened, the yields, well, they go down. The 10-year T-note sits at 2.11% to end the week. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is going to sound terrible because the human suffering that's involved in the European migrant crisis is real. But it's also real that clothing and feeding and housing that many people is a business opportunity. It's an opportunity, especially in Norway, a country of 5 million people that last year took in almost 32,000 refugees. Bill Donahue writes in the new Business Week about Hero Norway, the for-profit company run by two brothers that is making millions of dollars meeting the refugee demand. Bill, it's good to have you on.
It's great to be here.
Tell me about these two brothers, the Adolfsson brothers up in Norway.
Well, they run a number of businesses, but most notably, they are the top dogs in the sector of for-profit refugee centers in Norway. And they have 90 refugee centers there and 10 in Sweden.
It seems, or would seem, that this is ripe for, if not actual scandal, then the appearance of scandal. People profiting off of refugees. First of all, what's the vibe up in Norway where, you know, they are of a more liberal side of the political spectrum, shall we say?
Well, I think a lot of people recognize that you have to have these for-profit outfits because the government just can't handle them. But indeed, people are worried that the entrepreneurs are going to cut corners.
Mm-hmm.
And that did happen. There was a provider called Link. And, you know, they cut out things like childcare, homework help. So, yeah, it can happen. And the Norwegian equivalent of INS, UDI, is so overwhelmed at this point that they can't monitor these guys. So,
right.
Who knows what's happening?
You were in some of these centers, though. Tell me what they're like. I mean, what does it look like? What does it sound like?
Well, there's a variety of centers. You know, I went to one which is almost on the Swedish border, and the function of this place was to handle people right as they came into the country, and they were interviewed by police. They were screened for tuberculosis. Their clothes are put in this freezer for bed bugs. And people are sleeping in tents in there, but they're just there for a couple of days. And then you have more longer-term facilities, and those are much more copacetic place to live. There's detached housing. You cook for yourself. It's almost like a little neighborhood.
This is the sort of the Scandinavian welfare state, a little bit as we know it, but sort of with a capitalist bent, right? I mean, that's kind of what's going on here.
I, of course, like most Americans, I was thought that Scandinavia was purely socialist, and it was, you know, I was right there when Bernie Sanders praised it this summer. But, you know, it's not that simple. I mean, the reigning party there, the Progress Party, is extremely conservative. You know, there's a lot of things that are privatized. Nursery schools are privatized. Nursing homes are privatized. On and on. It's many, many industries there are.
What was your takeaway as you were leaving the last couple of days you were there? What was your takeaway about what's going to happen to these folks who are in these centers?
You know, I think they'll be okay. I spent a lot of time with Christian Adelson, the one brother who is primarily charged with running these centers. Mm-hmm. And their principal goal is to make money. But they also recognize that to do that on a long-term basis, you have to provide reasonable services. I think it'll be okay, but I think Norway is just, it's in for a rough ride. They've got so many people coming into the country, and there's a rising tide of resentment. It's a great experiment. I don't know how it's going to work out.
Bill Donahue writes in the new edition of Bloomberg Business Week about Norway and refugees and the business opportunities therein. Bill, thanks very much for your time.
Thanks a lot. It was great being on the show.
For as good as today's jobs report was, and it was, we got to be clear about that. There are some really big structural changes that have happened in the American labor market since the recession that we are still trying to figure out. What, for instance, has happened to all the people who left the labor force during the tougher times of the past 6 or 8 years? Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman is on that one.
There are 8 million fewer Americans aged 20 to 55 working or looking for work now than before the Great Recession. Labor force participation hasn't been this low since the 1970s. So what are all these people doing instead? How are they making ends meet? Let's begin with the 20-somethings just starting out.
Hey. You must be Maya.
Yeah.
I'm Mitchell. Hi.
Hey.
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
Maya Schurter is 22. She greets me in the stairwell up to her first floor studio apartment. It's in a suburban neighborhood of Portland, Oregon.
This is a nice little pad.
Yeah, I like it.
Nice and free. Schurter's parents live in the big house just up the hill. Her apartment's above the garage. Schurter graduated high school in 2011 and started looking for work.
I've had seasonal, like, retail jobs and lasted, like, a couple of months, but that's basically it. I've done probably, like, 150 resumes and applications.
A year ago, Schurter pretty much gave up. Just like many people her age have, faced with low wages and poor job prospects. The number of young people not participating in the labor force has risen by one-third since the recession. Most have gone to get more education or training. Schurter enrolled in a pre-apprenticeship program for construction union jobs.
I know I'll be having an amazing job soon that has benefits, like can offer me so much more than, you know, a typical like coffee shop job. I'm into a career now, not a job.
Now, there are a lot of reasons prime age workers have left the labor force since the recession. Some have gotten retraining, like Maya Schurter. Other main reasons, according to Labor Department surveys, illness and disability, taking care of kids, getting discouraged and giving up. None of which quite fits Ted Madry, 37, of San Francisco. He worked as a network engineer through the 2000s. He ran down his resume for me.
WorldCom MCI got laid off, and then they went bankrupt. Washington Mutual worked for them for a few years, got laid off, and they went bankrupt.
That was 2007, just as the recession was starting. All that bankruptcy got him thinking.
So I decided this seems like a clear sign. Let's give teaching dance a go.
For years, Madry'd been dancing, swing, ballroom, blues, in amateur competitions and exhibitions. So he went all in, started teaching dance classes and eventually putting on events. He performed with a troupe called The Boys, all Humphrey Bogart sharp suits and fedoras. He did this for the next 6 years. The work came in fits and starts. His income was one-sixth what it had been in tech and finance, but he says it was worth it.
I changed people's lives. I introduced six couples that got married. I had people leave private lessons with me and quit their jobs, realize what their calling was.
But Madry had quit his profession, and his savings were running low. So he decided to turn his small dance business into a nonprofit and pass it on to some friends and eventually started looking for work again. He's got a good story, creativity, self-reinvention, but he's been at it more than a year now with zero success.
It's been challenging. I've seen people react really negatively to my time out of technology, and it's a rare person that I talk to, especially in HR, who is impressed and appreciative of the work that I had done. Maybe they enjoy the story, but they don't find themselves wanting to hire me.
Madry says pretty soon he'll have to take a low-paid service job. He needs the money. And chances are he'll be competing with ever more people who dropped out of the job market and are now trickling back in as the economy rebounds. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today from the Marketplace desk of correlation is not necessarily causation, but it sure is interesting. Buried in that jobs report this morning was this, plucked out by the Wall Street Journal, I should say, credit where credit is due. The motion picture industry added 15,000 jobs last month. 15,000 after averaging a mere 700 a month for the past year or so. Figured it out yet? Come on. You got it, right? The force has indeed awakened. Movie theaters staffing up for the rush. There you go. I'm going to say this one more time, all right? The Dow is not the economy. The economy is not the Dow. All of that said, the blue chips off 167 points today, 1%. The NASDAQ off 45 points, 1% there as well. The S&P 500 down 21 points. About 1% is there. Look at that. Our theme music was composed by BJ Liederman. Marketplace is produced by Sitar Nieves. Deborah Clark is the vice president and executive producer around here. I'm Kai Rizdal. Have yourselves a good weekend, everybody. We are back on Monday. This is APM, right?
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.